We'll call this meeting to order, and we're going to start out with Volk Rehab today, and we're looking forward to a stimulating presentation. And before we start, I'd like to introduce a new member to this committee, Carly Moline. Welcome.
Thank you.
We're looking for a lot of good and strong input from you, by the way.
Okay.
And she took Representative Sirdis's place, which is a real special place to me, by the way. So I got to meet her when I went up and toured a mine last Friday.
Yes.
And she was always leading the parade. You're always ahead of course, young people do that. Anyway, we'll start off with give your name for the tape and start your presentation. We're looking forward to it.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Kimberly Peck. I'm the Director of Vocational Rehabilitation Services, a branch of the Workforce Development Division with the Department of Employment and Economic Development. It's quite a mouthful. Some of the materials that we've provided for your review include an annual report that looks like this for the State Vocational Rehabilitation Program, also copies of the PowerPoint presentation that I'll be using today. You know, the Vocational Rehabilitation Program,
Ernie.
Little technical difficulties. Vocational Rehabilitation Program, the mission, as you see here, is to empower Minnesotans with disabilities to achieve their goals for employment, independent living, and community integration. And these words really come to life when you hear or consider the stories of the people who've been impacted by vocational rehabilitation services. For instance, a student in Moorhead who suffered a traumatic brain injury, she was struggling to be able to continue successfully in college. The Vocational Rehabilitation Services Program provided services to her to purchase the assistance of a tutor, and because of that, she was able to complete her coursework, get the degree, and secure a position in her chosen field. Another example of one of the situations that we get involved with Vocational Rehabilitation Services, is a medical doctor who suffered a spinal cord injury, and as a result of that was quadriplegic. Were it not for the services of Vocational Rehabilitation Services, that gentleman would not have been able to continue to practice full-time as a physician. What's worth noting is that upon his return to full-time work, he was treating patients with spinal cord injuries. Another example of the individuals that we serve, transition age youth on the autism spectrum. This is an individual we were working with while in school, assisting that individual in managing the symptoms of his disorder and assisting him also in developing a career plan for himself. With the assistance of Vocational Rehabilitation Services, he learned to effectively manage the symptoms of his autism, was able to successfully complete college education in chemical engineering, and the first job that he received out of college, he was earning $76,000 per year. That would not have happened had it not been for the services of Vocational Rehabilitation Services. Another final example, a gentleman new to the United States, immigrating from Somalia with significant cognitive impairment. The Vocational Rehabilitation Services assisted him in setting up a small business in Minneapolis. All of those examples are examples of services provided by the Vocational Rehabilitation Program. It's important to keep in mind that the Vocational Rehabilitation Program really comprises of three distinct programs. The first one, Vocational Rehabilitation. The second, the Extended Employment Program. The third, the Independent Living Program. All of these programs work together to assist Minnesotans with significant disabilities that cause substantial impairment to employment. It assists them in securing employment, retaining those jobs, and being able to live independently and, as a result, reduce their dependence on government supports. It's essential that these programs work together. Each program does something different, but without the integration of these services, we will not be successful in assisting individuals in achieving a successful employment outcome. I want to make a note that the partners to Vocational Rehabilitation Services, the representatives of community rehab providers represented by MACRO, are here in the audience today. David Hancock, the executive director of the Metro Center for Independent Living, is here today. I think their presence here demonstrates the strong partnership that we have with our partners in Vocational Rehabilitation Services, and I think underscores the fact that it takes all of these programs to be able to accomplish the outcomes that that we achieve.
Ms. Peck,
yes.
Let me just interrupt you just for a moment. I want to record that we have a quorum present. Make sure that we document that. And the meeting will be called to order at this time. Thank you. Go ahead and continue, please.
Thank you. Let's start first with the Vocational Rehabilitation Program. The Vocational Rehabilitation Program is a short-term, time-limited employment and training program for persons with significant disabilities, where those disabilities create substantial impediments to their ability to be employed. The VR program, it's important to note that it is a federal-state partnership. For every $1 that the state of Minnesota invests in the Vocational Rehabilitation Program, the federal government makes available $3.71 to the state of Minnesota. It's estimated that the population of individuals in Minnesota with significant disabilities, long-lasting disabilities, borders on a quarter of a million people, and our estimates are that approximately 150,000 of those people would be eligible for vocational rehabilitation services. At this point in time, in this federal fiscal year, we anticipate serving almost 22,000 people. What I'm really excited about sharing with you this afternoon is that in federal fiscal year 2010, we were able to achieve 2,143 successful employment outcomes. What that means is individuals in competitive employment, stabilized in their job for at least 90 days, contributing to their communities and paying taxes. Yesterday, I made the point of looking to see where our numbers for federal fiscal year 11 look. And I was thrilled to see that at this point in time, this year, we are 290 employment outcomes ahead of where we were last year. And that's a testament not only of the amazing work that is done in vocational rehabilitation services, but it suggests to me that the economy is beginning to come back, and that's very good news for all of us. This gives you briefly a picture of how the VR dollars are invested. As you see here, the majority of resources are invested in services to customers, either services provided directly by vocational rehabilitation services staff or by services provided by community rehabilitation providers. As you see on the left, on the right-hand side of the page, that's that right-hand pie chart, you'll see that the biggest ticket items, the largest expenditures, are in services provided by community rehab providers as well as post-secondary education. The Vocational Rehabilitation Program is statewide. This here, as you see in this slide, and for those of you like myself with aging eyes, it might be easier to see in the back cover, inside back cover of the annual report. This provides the demographics of VR customers being served in every one of the 87 counties in Minnesota. So it may be worth looking at as it relates to your constituency. The other piece that's important to note is that the Vocational Rehabilitation Services Program is a partner in Minnesota's Workforce Center system. So the vast majority of our office locations are in the Workforce Centers throughout Minnesota. We do have four standalone offices, but again, it's important to note that the VR program is a partner in the one-stop system, consistent with the vision articulated in the Workforce Investment Act of 1998. And Minnesota, frankly, is one of the few states that whose VR program is as fully integrated into the one-stop system as we are. Now, the purpose of the Vocational Rehabilitation Program, really, as I said, it's time-limited. We cannot, by federal regulations, provide ongoing or long-term supports. So our focus is to provide skill training and job placement services to assist the individual in developing the skills they need to become competitively employed, to get that job, to get stabilized on that job, and when that happens, VR is obligated to step out of the picture. But many people with significant disabilities in Minnesota, in order for them to retain their employment, they need to have ongoing supports. And that's where the extended employment program comes in. As you see here in this slide that I pulled up, the extended employment program provides ongoing job supports to employ persons with significant disabilities. It's funded totally by state funds, in part general fund appropriation, the other part workforce development appropriation. We have more than 6,000 extended employment participants in 2010. And what I think is particularly noteworthy is those participants worked 4.3 million hours and earned more than $27 million in state fiscal year 2010. The extended employment resources are earned by community providers on pay-per-performance contracts. So it's an outcome-based system. And it is, again, remarkable. Minnesota is remarkable in that we are one of the few states that has made this level of commitment to provide ongoing supports. Were it not for the services of the extended employment program and the providers that provide those supports, individuals would not be able to keep their jobs. They would lose their jobs, and they would, again, fall back and become dependent on public benefits.
Yep. Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Can I ask a question, please? Mr. Chairman? I was just interested in the evaluation of when we needed extended employment. Once a person is on extended employment services, is that pretty much going to be something they continue on, or is there a point where it's being, you know, evaluated again occasionally, or how often?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, the answer to that question is that under the extended employment rule, it's required that every year the community rehab provider evaluate the individual's employment plan. And if they demonstrate the ability to no longer need those supports, then they would be closed from the program. However, because the Minnesota rule governing the extended employment program requires that individuals have three or more functional limitations in order to qualify for the services, these are individuals with very significant disabilities. So, unfortunately, the capacity of the extended employment program is such that there isn't a whole lot of movement in the program. And so we really, Minnesota, we are at capacity at this point in time. Certainly when individuals choose to retire or should they die, then that opens up a slot. But that, frankly, is one of the challenges that we have in the vocational rehabilitation services system, because in the VR, that first part of the continuum of services, if the VR counselors can't find a source to provide ongoing supports for those individuals that need it, we can't even begin to provide services to that individual. And so that's, again, Minnesota's fortunate in that we provide or we invest in extended employment, but the need that exists far outstrips the resources that are available.
Thank you. Follow up? Go ahead and proceed then.
All right.
Yep.
Another thing that I want to emphasize about the extended employment program is that, again, the VR program, that first part of the continuum of services, we are not allowed by federal regulations to provide ongoing supports. So that's the critical importance of the extended employment program, because were it not for those ongoing support services, individuals would lose their jobs. So we have the VR program that's assisted with skill training, securing the job, providing the placement, making sure the individual is stable in his or her job, then enter the extended employment program for those people that require ongoing supports. But frankly, none of that is going to matter if the individual is unable to get out of his house or doesn't know how to use a bus transportation in order to get to work. And that's where the extended employment, that's where the independent living program fits in. As you see here on this slide, the independent living program in Minnesota is funded both by state funds and federal funds. Primarily, those services are delivered by a network of 8 centers for independent living. In federal fiscal year 2010, more than 7,000 people were served by the centers. One of the things that I think is especially worth noting is that the VR counselors, again, that first part of the continuum where they're providing job skills training, assistance and placement, we have found that independent living services are so value added that we have invested a significant amount of our Social Security program income in making it possible for staff from the Centers for Independent Living to be co-located in the VR offices. Because we can have a counselor, the counselors carry a caseload of about 100 to 120 people, and if they're working diligently with an individual to develop an employment plan, and all of a sudden the individual loses his housing, or they have a health crisis, our counselors do not have the resources or the ability to take a step back from focusing on an employment plan and deal with those critical issues that put the individual's ability to live independently in jeopardy. That's where the services for the Independent Living Center fit in. Again, they've been immensely value-added, and again, I think provides a powerful demonstration that all of these services, three programs, VR, extended employment, independent living, are separate programs but come together in an integrated fashion to assist individuals in being successful in competitive employment. As I said, the three programs work together.
Can I ask a question since we're on that slide? Where do the counties get involved? I understand that there are people at the county level that help in determining who gets the independent living. How does that work?
Mr. Chair, let me do my best to answer that question. Certainly, there are a full range of services that are funded by Medicaid funding that would pass from the state to the counties, and there are some employment-related services that are funded by the counties and by Medicaid. To my knowledge, I don't know that the counties would make any determination about whether individuals would be available for the independent living services that are provided from the centers. Certainly Mr. Hancock's would probably be in a better position to be able to answer that question that he's here. So if you'd like, we could certainly call Mr. Hancock's up.
Mr. Hancock, is he here?
I believe that he is. He said he was going to be here and bring his tuba.
He's welcome to come on up and answer that if he can.
Where's the tuba?
I left the brass band out in the hallway.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. Thank you. My name is David Hancock. I'm the Executive Director at the Metropolitan Center for Independent Living, serving the 7-county metro area of Minneapolis-St. Paul, and I'm also Vice Chair of the State Association of Centers for Independent Living. And, Mr. Chair, if you would do me the pleasure of repeating your question so that I make sure that I answer it effectively.
My question is where do the counties get involved in determining independent living? My understanding is they do, and it could very well be they don't. But I'm interested in who makes that determination.
Okay. It's a very good question, Mr. Chair, and thank you for asking it. In actuality, the counties do not determine eligibility for independent living center services. The Centers for Independent Living provide services to individuals with all types of disability. There's no minimum qualification for services. Anybody with any type of disability, any age group, any socioeconomic background, et cetera, is eligible for services at a Center for Independent Living. All the individual has to do, quite frankly, is make themselves available, present themselves to a Center for Independent Living seeking support and services. The significant difference between the Centers for Independent Living and perhaps some other social services models is that the person with the disability is often, very often, kept in the driver's seat. Okay. So when that person presents themselves looking for a different type of service, it is the individual who, with this assistance from staff at the center by all means, but it is really the individual with the disability that determines what services and what goals and objectives they want to set and pursue.
Thank you.
Answer your question.
It does. It's more of a direct model, it
right.
sounds like. Okay.
And, Mr. Chair, just in addition to that briefly, we do work collaboratively with the counties. We receive a lot of referrals from counties, but the counties do not establish eligibility for independent living services.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, sir. My pleasure.
Appreciate that.
My pleasure.
Ms. Speck, would you like to proceed?
Yeah, the final slide, the final comment that I want to make is that, as you see on this slide, this is language taken directly from the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 as amended. And as you see there, it states that the goals of the nation properly include, under letter B, achieve equality of opportunity, full inclusion and integration in society, employment, independent living, and economic and social self-sufficiency for individuals with disabilities. That, in essence, is the work of Vocational Rehabilitation Services in partnership with the VR program, that state-federal partnership, the extended employment program, and the services from the Centers for Independent Living, as Mr. Hancock's described. It's because of those services and that partnership that individuals who otherwise would not be able to be competitively employed would be much more dependent on public supports. So at this point, I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much, Ms. Peck. Are there any questions? Representative Gunther.
I'd just like to make a statement, Mr. Chairman, that Ms. Peck, I've heard how well you take care of those people that you have in charge, in your charge. I hear glowing reports about how you ferret out federal money for this program and that program. So I want to thank you as a person who wants to guard our general fund dollars very carefully to your creativeness and how you go ahead and leverage money.
Thank you. You know, I came into this position about 5 years ago, and my strong belief is that the only way that we can accomplish this complicated and complex work is through partnerships. And I have focused a lot of my time and energy in the last 5 years in strengthening those critical partnerships, and I think because of that, we see the number of successful outcomes that we're getting increasing substantially. So I appreciate the feedback. Thank you very much.
Anyone else? Thank you very much, Ms. Peck.
Thank you.
Next is the State Services for the Blind, Mr. Richard Strong. And while he is approaching the podium, we'll go ahead and approve the minutes. Would Representative Gunther like to make a motion?
I was here and I thoroughly reviewed the minutes and I approve them completely.
All those in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
I have a correction, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I did hear that. So we'll strike that.
Tony Sertich is listed.
Correction. Go ahead.
Tony Sertich is listed as being here.
Well, let's go and strike that.
Well, this week he kind of sort of is. Much prettier version.
Yeah. This week it's different. That's correct. But this is for on the 22nd. So therefore, we'll strike that. Are there any other changes that anybody sees? Well, let's go ahead and vote again. All those in favor of the corrected minutes, say aye.
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 All
right. Okay. Opposed? So go ahead and those will be approved. Mr. Strong, please go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Richard Strong, S-T-R-O-N-G. I'm the Director of State Services for the Blind. Been in that position for the last 14 months, been with the agency for over 28 years. Very much welcome the opportunity to appear before this committee and to thank you and the Minnesota Legislature who in 1923 established State Services for the Blind as a state agency. We have a long history of service to the people of Minnesota, and we very much appreciate your support in that regard.
Thank you.
Services for the Blind was formed in 1923 as a result of input from the citizens of the state calling for such an agency to be formed, and we continue to work with the citizens of the state in our program. Our mission of State Services for the Blind is to facilitate the achievement of vocational and personal independence by Minnesotans who are blind, visually impaired, and deafblind. Key term is that we facilitate that achievement. We don't do it to people, we do it with people. And we do it in partnership with consumer organizations, with our gubernatorially appointed State Rehabilitation Council for the Blind, and with our community partners throughout the state. We do focus on providing services to all Minnesotans who are blind, visually impaired, or deafblind. We've had to limit our services in recent years, specifically back in 2002 because of some budget adjustments at that time and some shifts in other legislation in previous years. We no longer provide direct services to children. We did limit our children's program back then. Organizationally, we are part of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And in the lower right-hand corner of this slide, you'll note the Workforce Development Division. We are a part of that division within the Department of Employment and Economic Development. I believe this was a slide that you'd looked at last week with Commissioner Phillips. Within State Services for the Blind, we have basically four units. We have an overall administrative services unit that supports the agency in its functioning and carries out a variety of administrative tasks at State Services for the Blind. We have our workforce development program that focuses on employment outcomes for blind, visually impaired, deafblind Minnesotans. We have a position of a director of our Communication Center and Senior Services, currently vacant position, provides overall leadership for our Communication Center and our Senior Services unit. And we have an Access and Assistive Technology program that provides support statewide to our employment program, as well as services to business throughout the state, making their programs accessible. Our workforce development program assists individuals to become employed. Our senior services works with seniors throughout the state to give them the tools that they need to remain independent in their homes. Our communication center, that's a report that is in your packet. This is a public-private partnership that's been around since 1953. It provides access to print material to individuals who have barriers to accessing the printed word. We believe that literacy is an essential component for all Minnesotans, and persons with barriers to accessing print ought to have means to access the printed word, and that's what our communication center does. Our assistive technology unit provides specialized software, devices, and technical consultations throughout the state to make job sites, training programs, and indeed state systems available to persons with barriers to accessing the printed word. In terms of the demographics of the populations that exist here in Minnesota that we target for our services, those estimates vary between 75,000 and 222,000 blind, visually impaired Minnesotans. We've been collaborating with the University of Minnesota's Minnesota State Survey for the last several years, trying to get a better handle on the population of persons with blindness and visual impairments in Minnesota. And back in 2008, the estimate that came from their study was about 6% incident rate of households in Minnesota contain a person who has blindness or visual impairment. Transfer to about 200, upwards of 200,000 persons targeted for potential services. Three quarters of the people that we serve in all of State Services for the Blind units are over the age of 60. The primary cause of blindness that we have in Minnesota, because of where we come from, primarily a Northern European population, is something that's called age-related macular degeneration. The incidence of AMD is much greater in folks from the Northern European areas than it is in folks from other areas. I happen to be of Irish heritage, and it may be coming to me soon. Other causes of blindness include glaucoma, diabetic retinopathy. We see an increase in diabetes here in the United States, also in Minnesota. Retinitis pigmentosa, a congenital disability, accident, and other congenital conditions. For the forthcoming biennium, for the two-year period, the recommended base for the governors from the governor's budget is reflected on this slide. Please note that we receive funding from a variety of different sources. Our funding base is somewhat broad. We'd like to have it be broader. We do receive substantial funds from the general fund. We also receive substantial federal dollars that are available to us for our vocational rehabilitation program, as well as our independent living program. We'll mention that shortly. We receive federal stimulus funds, also receive special revenue funds. Mentioned briefly our business enterprises program. Some of you may have over in the Capitol gotten a snack from Mr. Lee in the vending program there. That's a program that State Services for the Blind supports. About 48 vendors throughout the state. We're functioning in a franchise arrangement with State Services for the Blind, and what they do is there's a set aside fee that is paid to State Services for the Blind by those entrepreneurs. We also receive an amount of funds through gifts, the contributions that are made to State Services for the Blind to support our activities and efforts in serving the citizens of the state. Critical issue that's important for me to express is why there is a State Services for the Blind. Critical component that makes State Services for the Blind an essential service for Minnesotans is what we call Adjustment to Blindness Services. And ATB is what makes State Services unique. Adjustment to Blindness Skills are alternative skills that blind people need in order to compete in the global economy of the 21st century, in order to retain their homes and to be an integrated member of our society. These skills include communication skills like Braille and the use of access technology. JAWS is a program that allows folks to access the computer. Cane travel, being able to travel safely and independent in their community, in the work setting. Home management skills, different ways, new ways to do old things when you lose your vision. You still want to be able to cook. You want to be able to make sure that your socks match. If you happen to use makeup, you want to be able to do that properly and effectively. And also leisure time pursuits, to be a part of the community, to be integrated into your community of faith, to be able to access your hymnal, to be able to read your Danielle Steele novel if you're so inclined, or something that might be a bit more substantive. But the skills that are taught through the Adjustment to Blindness training programs and services that we provide directly and that also come from our community partners help customers, help the people we serve gain a positive attitude about themselves and the capabilities that they have to be a part of the community, to go to work, to care for their children, take care of their grandchildren, and to be a contributing member of society. A phrase that I use is that persons who go to work and moan, groan, and complain about their taxes like everybody else. And I like to hear that because that means people are working. It's an expensive process, but it's essential if people are going to be successfully employed and live independently. Medical insurance doesn't cover it. Congresswoman Griffin from Arizona is involved in a rehabilitation program right now, making excellent progress, and we're very pleased to hear that. That program's covered by her insurance. An individual who's blind may go into the hospital following an accident. Their physical restoration, covered by insurance generally. The adjustment to blindness and learning how they're going to be functioning as an independent person isn't covered by their insurance. That's an expensive proposition. The State Services for the Blind, State of Minnesota, the federal government takes care of. There may be a question.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, and I think that's a pretty significant comment that you're making. So would you be willing to support us requiring and mandating that our insurance companies cover these services?
Go ahead.
Good question. I don't have an answer for that.
Until he gets told what he thinks.
I think that, Representative Clark, I think that's our job. We have to go to Commerce with a bill that says that.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll join you.
Go ahead and continue.
Adjustment to blindness services is an absolutely critical service that we do provide. It's very important for blind people to receive that service, one way or the other. I mentioned that we partner with entities and organizations. We do have our State Rehabilitation Council for the Blind, appointed by the governor. It's called for federally through the Rehabilitation Act amendments of back in the 90s. The people of the state of Minnesota were very progressive, and back in the 80s, they called for a Minnesota Council for the Blind. So we were ahead of the curve in that area in terms of active participation by the citizenry in our services. State Services for the Blind cooperates with and partners with a variety of agencies throughout the state. We work with Blind Incorporated in Minneapolis to provide services, blindness, learning, and new dimensions, that's what the initials stand for. We work with the Duluth Lighthouse for the Blind up in Duluth and providing services in northeastern Minnesota. We work with Vision Loss Resources based in Minneapolis and providing services. We also work with Employment Endeavors out of St. Paul, that provides job placement services for individuals who are deafblind. In addition to these center-based programs, we also work with over 20 individual contractors throughout the state in providing itinerant services to the citizens of Minnesota. On our council are representatives from consumer organizations and advocacy groups in the state, include the American Council of the Blind, the National Federation of the Blind of Minnesota, the United Blind of Minnesota, and the Minnesota Deaf Blind Association. We also work very closely with the Commission of Deaf, Deaf Blind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans, and Mary Hartle and her efforts and activities to ensure access for all. Most importantly, we're an active partner in the Workforce Center system here in Minnesota. Although a small organization relative to vocational rehabilitation services, SSB staff are located in 10 workforce centers throughout the state, and we provide services on a statewide basis. As Ms. Peck mentioned, we have federal-state partnership. Our federal dollars come to Minnesota at the rate of 3.7 for every dollar invested by the state. Those rehabilitation services are the services that we provide that are necessary to help individuals prepare for, seek, gain, and retain employment. We save people's jobs. Quite often, our access and assistive technology unit will go out and work with an employer, work with an individual at a job site so they don't lose their job, so they can keep their job. Some of the services that we provide are vocational assessment and counseling, adjustment to blindness training services that I've mentioned, vocational training, job seeking skills, OJT, on the job training programs, internships, job placement services, and the important follow-up services to ensure that the employment situation is stable for the individual in our workforce development program. We serve over 1,000 individuals each year. 98% of the persons that we serve are individuals with significant disabilities. That means that the individual who has a severe disability, they're going to require multiple services over an extended period of time. These are multiple barriers that individuals have to employment, and those are the folks that we work with. Right now, for this past year, successful outcomes averaged over $11 an hour. It's down somewhat from our previous years, may be reflective of some difficulties in the economy. We need to do a better job in providing quality services to individuals that we serve. Over the last 4 years, we've had 332 successful employment outcomes. One of the elements of our workforce development program is our business enterprises program that I mentioned, the franchise program for legally blind individuals to operate their own vending businesses throughout the state. We do have, it's in the governor's budget, a request that's for a $300,000 investment in additional dollars for federal match that would bring down $1.1 million over the biennium.
Mr. Strong, just out of curiosity, you have 1,000 individuals per year that you serve.
Correct.
That get paid $11 an hour, and you have 332 successful outcomes over the last 4 years.
Correct.
So that's less than 100 a year. That's less than 10%.
Yes, sir.
Have successful outcomes. Is that comparable to other states?
The number of competitive employment outcomes as a proportion of the individuals that we serve, it is comparable. There are a variety of factors that we're compared on, one of which is the numbers of individuals with significant disabilities who are placed. Another is the earnings that individuals receive. Another is the competitive employment ratio that is realized. Back in the day, State Services for the Blind provided services through a vocational rehabilitation program to many persons who ended up as homemakers. And you'll see
of these 1,000 individuals per year, what is the average age of those individuals? It could be macular degeneration that happens in later years. Is that what we're looking at here?
We're not looking at that here. I don't have the average age of those closures. I can get that number for you. I do know that in our senior services program, the average age of person served there is about 82 and a half.
Mm-hmm. 82 and a half?
Yes, sir.
That's even older than me.
Barely.
Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
Answer my question.
But we can get that figure for you.
I appreciate that.
Yes, sir. As we look at the change item and the $300,000 investment that we're looking at over the biennium would permit us to draw down $1.1 million of federal monies over the biennium. We wouldn't be able to access all of the available funds that are projected to be available federally without the additional match. There have been, this past year, over $136 million returned to the federal agency in the Department of Education by other states of monies that they were unable to match. The state of Ohio turned in, I believe, over $39 million last year. If we don't receive an increased match, we have some choices to make in terms of how State Services for the Blind provides its services to individuals. We could draw money away from services to seniors, to that 82.5 or so year old population that we provide services to, and to children who are served through our communication center. Could serve fewer customers and implement an order of selection in our vocational rehabilitation program, or a combination of both. If we do receive the change item, what we would want to do is to improve our employment outcomes. We've had some experimental programs with ERA dollars over the last year and a half or so, looking at bringing on to our staff individuals who are experienced in a, we call them headhunters, if you will, in the private sector, and increasing our ability to provide placement services to our customers. We're very, very focused on increasing our employment outcomes, as perhaps noted in your observations.
Representative McFarland.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Strong, you mentioned about returning federal money back to the Department of Education.
Yes, sir.
Is that
yes,
where
ma'am.
Most of your federal money comes from?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, Yes. It comes from the Rehabilitation Services Administration, which is part of the Office of Special Education and Rehabilitation Services within the U.S. Department of Education.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Strong, so including senior services would be come from that department then too?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, ma'am.
Representative Clark has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned that you might also use those dollars to deal with communication center services for children. Earlier you said that we're not serving children. Can you describe what part we are serving? Apparently we do something, but is this a ongoing service that we would expand or just keep going? And why? I guess I'm interested in your recommendations for serving children.
Mr. Strong.
Mr. Chairman. Within the communication center, I mentioned earlier, sort of a public library for persons where they have access to material in an accessible format that isn't available elsewhere. We have an interagency agreement with the Minnesota Department of Education where we act as a one-stop for educators throughout the state in the K-12 service system to provide Braille educational material for them. We at State Services for the Blind supplement that agreement that we have with the Department of Education to a substantial degree. Over the last several years, that supplement that we've provided has averaged, and it averages, in the neighborhood of approximately $350,000 worth of state monies. The choice that we have, 3.7 for a buck of federal money that we draw down. There's a certain return on the investment of the $1 to get the federal monies. Take the money away from supplementing services in the communication center, put that into the match so we can continue to draw down the federal money, and then there's a void someplace in our other programs. That may be, we don't make decisions on spur of the moment, it may have an effect on the communication center. Where we spend state non-match dollars in SSB are in the communication center, where we provide services literacy-based, or in our senior services for the older blind. Those are basically the two areas, in addition to drawing down federal match, that we spend state dollars.
Clark.
Chairman, I'm a little confused by both that answer and then what I see on the slide here. Without the match, this says we would draw money away from seniors and children.
Right.
You know, maybe there isn't time for a lot of discussion of this now, but I would be very interested in what your thoughts are about how we can serve children the way we maybe, how did we used to serve children before 2002, I think you said, and what's missing for these kids? I'm just interested if there's some other way we could figure out how to not be having the little ones compete against the older ones.
Mr. Strong.
Mr. Chairman, would love to engage in that conversation. It's a very difficult situation that we're facing.
Okay.
Those choices. It's not a pleasant situation.
Strong, go ahead and continue.
Thank you. Our senior services unit, as I've mentioned, we train, work with seniors to maintain their personal independence, remain in their homes. Better to be in your home, I would think. It's cheaper from a public policy perspective. It does include adjustment to blindness training and low vision services, train individually or in groups. In 2010, over 3,600 were served, and that number's rising. There's this issue of the age wave. We know Minnesota's population is increasing at the upper end of the spectrum. 91% of the persons that we served back in 2010 reported feeling that they are in greater control and are more confident in their ability to maintain their current living situation as a result of the services that we provided. That's a standard question that we run through with every service recipient.
Representative Stensford has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, we were talking about the matching dollars, and you get, you know, for every dollar you get more federal money. What kind of mandates are coming down from the federal government in terms of how you're able to spend that money? Do they mandate you have to use it in certain ways?
Mr. Chairman? For both the vocational rehabilitation program and the older individuals who are blind program in our senior services unit, there are, of course, federal regulations and requirements that govern how those funds are expended. The regulatory requirements are a bit more mature, should one say, because they've been around longer for the vocational rehabilitation program, and much more extensive guidance is provided federally for the vocational rehabilitation program, much less so for the older blind program, where we receive approximately $500,000 of federal money for that program.
Representative Stenger.
Yeah, just one follow-up, and thank you, Mr. Chair. Does that make your job harder? I'm not sure how to gauge your reaction. You're being very nice and polite. I'm wondering, do those mandates kind of get in the way of doing what you really wished you could get done, or does it fall in line with what you do with that money anyways?
Mr. Strong.
Mr. Chairman, sir, certainly the guidance that's offered for the older individuals who are blind program provides more flexibility and greater opportunities for creativity. The regulations that govern the vocational rehabilitation program do put limits on some of the activities that we can carry out. They have matured over time, and they've certainly, I'm sure, for every regulation that there's a reason for it.
Thank you.
Representative Swedinski, you have a question.
Mr. Chair, my question would be to, you know, are you doing any partnerships, you know, as far as any other federal things? Are there any things going on with veterans at all, or, you know, and how does that work as far as what you do?
Chairman?
Beyond finances.
Beyond, like, finances.
Yeah, we do collaborate with the VA, especially in terms of many of our veterans are older persons now, and we do collaborate with them in terms of services, especially with the VA hospital here. And we do have a relationship in our vocational rehabilitation program with the Veterans Administration as well. There's a grant program with one of the community rehabilitation programs, Blind Incorporated here in the Twin Cities, that is working on developing its capacity to provide services to veterans. There's a blind rehabilitation program out of Hines Hospital in Illinois that we also, from time to time, have relationships with. That's a piece of it.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, I have a lot of questions. This is an issue that's very, really close to me, and I just I'm glad you mentioned the connection with the veterans. I actually have two people in the 80s, and my dad happens to be 95. Both of them make use of services for people with macular degeneration. One of the things I've noticed is my aunt, who's served by the State Services for the Blind, my father, who's served by veterans, are missing a certain help in terms of using the resources that come to them. One of them, and I've talked a little bit with some people about this, I just want to put it on the record. My dad receives all kinds of, you know, talking books, what am I trying to say? Discs that he can use, mm-hmm. and he can use them. But you know what? He lacks the help to be able to put them to use. And the training that's needed for that means that he has stacks of sitting there that are not used. And so just that kind of service, I just want to say, if there was some way, and that's a veterans service deficit, and I've talked to him about it, but, and I don't know if the State Services for the Blind has that same deficit, but it just seems to me like it's a great resource that's not being used because there's not the home visit to put it together with a person who can't see well enough to put it into the machine. So I'm just pointing that out because I think it's a great service, but it's, at least in the case of a close family member, it's not being properly utilized, and maybe that could change.
Mr. Strong.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark. Personal question, if I may. So
sure.
If you have the new machine, what are you talking about?
Yeah, not sure.
Okay, well, the new machine is a digital machine. It's not a cassette player. It's not yellow. But it's a new machine, and the insertion of the cartridge is significantly improved. It used to be the cassette, and you had to find that. It's a new machine that came out last year.
Oh, he doesn't have that.
And those are now available for all Minnesotans, and it's significantly improved. It was a long time coming, and it's out there, and I dare say.
Thanks for the information. I appreciate it.
It's much better, yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. It's pictured in the piece that we'll get to in my next half hour.
You don't have that long. Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Strong, right here.
Yes.
I have an 87-year-old mother-in-law that's going through losing her sight, but I don't know how we connect her. I mean, I should know, being a legislator, but she's not connected with services. How does, and she's German and somewhat stubborn and doesn't want to ask for help. I love her dearly. So how do we get these services to the people who need them that are reluctant to ask for the help? Where do they go?
Give us a call. We'll have someone go visit her.
Greetings.
Mr. Chairman,
we have two other groups to testify yet, so we probably should try to wrap this up. Mm-hmm. And I know you've been having a lot of very good questions. Appreciate your answering them.
Thank you. Well, here's the bad news. We know the number of seniors in Minnesota, seniors with vision loss, steadily rise over the next 20 years, anticipated doubling by 2030. The pressures on our service system, state services for the blind, to accommodate and provide services to those individuals. We have set priorities. We've modified and realigned staff. We've adjusted the territories that people serve. We've improved the training that we provide to our staff to be more effective and efficient. We've developed resources to educate staffs of assisted living facilities and nursing homes, and we've begun to limit the services that we're able to provide in long-term care situations because we simply don't have the resources as we look to this silver tsunami that's coming at us.
I'd like to also tell the members, if they have a chance, we have a chance, we'll take a tour of State Services for the Blind because it's a very good tour. They have reading rooms where they read the newspapers via the radio receivers that they have. Mm-hmm. And they do provide a lot of services, not only for our state, but other states. It's a service that people really appreciate.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of our communication center, and as you were, sir, we lend transcribed textbooks and leisure books and braille and tape on compact disc and via the internet. We operate the Radio Talking Book Network, first one in the world, founded here in Minnesota. Celebrated our 40th anniversary last year. We lend and repair radios and equipment for the Library of Congress Talking Book Program that the representative was speaking of that her father was using. That Library of Congress program is celebrating its 80th anniversary on March 3rd, next week. And we're a party to that, and I understand there may well be a proclamation by our governor regarding that day. We also have a local radio reading service in six communities throughout the state where people can have access to their local newspapers up in Fergus Falls and in Grand Rapids and in Duluth and in Mankato and in Rochester and in St. Cloud.
Representative Mulroy, you got a question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at their claims on what they're doing in Braille, and I'm getting constituents who are complaining that the number of people being trained in Braille is really decreasing a lot, and they're concerned about the young not getting training in Braille and being pushed into these other things, and yet sometime in life may need Braille. And so what, have you got any ideas on how to solve that issue?
Mr. Strong.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulvey. Our Braille section produces high-quality Braille in a timely manner for the children of this state. We supplement that service with the monies that you provide to us. The educational system is the responsible entity for providing the instruction in how to read Braille. A few years ago, this legislature passed what was referred to as the Braille Bill, which called for the instruction in Braille to be the default position for any person in the K-12 system who was blind. And that was a step in the direction of encouraging the use and the teaching of Braille. There is a shortage of teachers of Braille in the United States, and Minnesota is no exception to that. That's an issue that the educational system is working on. We have, in our conference rooms at State Services for the Blind, conducted training sessions in conjunction with the universities in Braille for the teachers who are involved in becoming teachers of the blind and visually impaired. But you're exactly right, sir. There is a huge shortage of teachers, qualified teachers of Braille in the United States.
And members, if you could possibly hold the questions down so we can finish this presentation, we would appreciate it so we can get at the other two groups to testify. Thank you. Continue. Thank you. With the utmost dispatch, please.
We're almost there, sir. I mentioned earlier that private funding remains an important part of the funding mix for state services for the blind. We've worked since 1953 with the HAM Family Foundation of the St. Paul Foundation to leverage the interests of the public in supporting the efforts of state services for the blind. The report that's in your packets is a product of that public-private partnership. It's the stories are told here of persons who benefited from the services that are made available through state services for the blind. A young woman who benefited from Braille, who fought to have Braille in her classes, is now attending university and will be a leader of tomorrow. Of a young man who's in our business enterprises program, is an entrepreneur, is making money, and is has material for his business provided by the Communication Center of State Services for the Blind. Mr. Chairman, you mentioned we have recording booths where the newspapers are read. We have over 650 community volunteers who volunteer their time to provide access to the printed word to Minnesotans through the Communication Center. Our assistive technology unit, I've mentioned that. We consult with employers to help individuals maintain their employment so that we don't have to have folks losing their jobs and having to go back and be involved in the job search. We know it's much easier to keep a job than it is to get a job. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the time that the committee has allowed me to provide just a touch on the services that we offer, and we welcome the opportunity to have the committee visit State Services for the Blind. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much for your presentation. And members, if you have any further questions, please call one of DEED personnel, and they'll get the questions answered for you. And with that, we have LifeTrack Resources. Now we have approximately 35 minutes before we have to be in a, have to start going to the House floor, so try to get half of that, will you? Thank you.
Hello, members of the committee. My name is Diane Helt, H-E-L-D-T, and I'm the Director of Immigrant and Refugee Services at the nonprofit agency LifeTrack Resources. LifeTrack is the lead organization in a collaborative with Vietnamese Social Services in St. Paul and Intercultural Mutual Assistance Association in Rochester, Minnesota. Our collaboration is unique in that the staff members speak 19 different languages, and because of this, we're able to offer job skills and support to refugees in a way that most nonprofit agencies and church groups cannot. Over the past 13 years, our Career Employment Collaborative has assisted more than 5,400 refugees and has placed more than 3,900 refugees and immigrants with challenges to employment. The people we serve have English language barriers, educational limitations, and cultural barriers that get in the way of employment. They have a strong desire to work and obtain training. We offer them individualized, culturally sensitive services. We assist individuals to find work by helping them fill out job applications, driving them to interviews, and supporting them on the first day of work by providing language translation for their employer and for themselves. We consistently have a waiting list of individuals to participate in the program. Our results have been remarkable. Employers express high levels of satisfaction with the good workers that are attracted through this program. Over the past year, our collaborative has worked with employers in Greater Minnesota who are in need of workers, and we have assisted refugees in relocating into these areas, which include Rochester, Worthington, Minnesota, Albert Lea, Marshall, and Wilmer. Our clients are high contributing workers for both small and large businesses, and we're able to assist these employees to be successful in this recovering economy. LifeTrack is an effective and efficient agency that provides proven results in employment services, which benefit many types of job seekers and employers. I want to read for you one quote from a local employer. He's the general manager of Cooperative Plating in St. Paul. He said about our program, "This program helps us to maintain a prosperous business and a productive workforce. Our experience has been overwhelmingly positive. This program has provided us with a network to obtain employees that have the desire to work and to be long-term employees. The program pre-screens applicants, thus saving our company time and money. They provide language training and various other services to assist individuals in obtaining and keeping their jobs, which helps with their transition into the community." Our career collaborative has consistently exceeded program outcomes. In the past 12 months, our program has assisted 36 individuals to terminate from public assistance in Minnesota, which has saved the state of Minnesota more than $253,000 in MFIP cash and food stamps. The state of Minnesota additionally benefits from this program by having our clients working and paying taxes. Now I'd like to introduce Alita, who will tell you about her experience with the career program as a participant.
Welcome to our committee. Would you give your name so we can know you are here 100 years from now?
My name is Alita.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you. I live in Rochester, Minnesota right now. I'm originally from Eritrea, Africa. I came to the U.S.
You want to bring that microphone over a little bit? Yeah. That way the tape and us will hear you.
Thank you. My name is Elisa. I live in Rochester, Minnesota right now, and I am originally from Eritrea. I came to the United States in November 2008 to Winona, Minnesota. I moved to Rochester in January 2010 with my two kids. Despite the fact that I was well educated and I spoke English well, I still needed assistance with finding employment, housing, school, and daycare for my kids. I heard of IMA and decided to give them a call to see if there is a program that I can that can help me with. I was connected with a counselor in the career program. I explained my situation to the counselor, and he was able to assist me with many issues that I was facing at the time. He connected me with Olmsted County Financial Services, where I was able to get some MFIP grants and help with my transportation costs. Also, he pointed out nursing assistant program in which I enrolled myself and obtained my nursing assistant certificate. While going to school, my counselor thought it's a good idea if I start volunteering somewhere to gain some experience, since I didn't have any in the United States. I started volunteering at IMA's front desk. A month later, they offered me a part-time job at the same place. My counselor assisted me in making my resume, and after I was done with nursing assistant program, he pointed out job opening at Mayo Clinic. I applied and I was hired. I'm currently working full-time as PCA at Mayo Clinic, where I receive great benefit and salary too. I am off public assistance, and I was able to buy my own house in Rochester. I greatly appreciate all the help I received from this program. I can't emphasize enough the importance of having a program there to help a person in time of need like me. We all strive to make a better life for us and our families, to become self-sufficient. I'm thankful for having a counselor at IMA who made this road to self-sufficiency and made it less bumpy to me. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Any questions from the members? Seeing none, you must have done a wonderful job. They understand it all now.
Thank you.
Thank you. And next we have Boys and Girls Club. Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record again.
Thank you.
Hello.
Your name?
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Erin Carlin. I am the CEO and president for the Boys and Girls Clubs of the Twin Cities. We are here representing the Boys and Girls Clubs Minnesota State Alliance and the Workforce Development Grant. The teenage unemployment rate right now is at 25%, the highest it has been since the Bureau of Labor Statistics began keeping track of the data in 1948. Teens are three times as likely to be unemployed in comparison to adults. That is why this Workforce Development Grant is so important to our future and to our youth. In your packet, you'll find the Boys and Girls Club information, and the title on it is Great Futures Start Here, and it has the Alliance information on logo as well. Each year, the Boys and Girls Clubs provide over 57,500 youth with training needed for bright futures. We enable young people, especially those who need us most, to reach their full potential as productive, caring, and responsible citizens. There are 10 Minnesota Boys and Girls Club corporations in 33 cities with 52 club locations. Working with almost 3,000 youth every day, our clubs are in a unique position to prepare our youth to be job ready. Through your support over the past 5 years, the Boys and Girls Clubs have taught 21,500 youth the skills and tools needed to succeed in our workforce. Each year, over 4,500 youth have participated in our programs, including Career Launch, where youth explore careers and develop career paths, Job Ready. This is a 12-week program that teaches a young person how to seek, apply, and maintain employment. Goals for Growth. Youth learn in this program how to set and achieve basic goals. And Smart Moves. This teaches kids the link between personal decisions, lifestyles, and job marketability. In all of our programs, we have over 70% completion rates. Our program changes youth's lives today while preparing the workforce of our future. And all of this for a program delivery cost of $165.70 per child. The Boys and Girls Clubs meet and exceed all of our grant expectations with the youth that we're working with. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Mark Sockery.
Chairman Gunther, representatives, my name is Mark Sockery, Director of Boys and Girls Clubs of Central Minnesota out of St. Cloud. I want to start with a thank you. Thank you for funding our workforce development programs throughout the past 6 years throughout Minnesota. You have made a good investment, and you should be very proud of what has been accomplished. On a personal note, I bring you greetings from retired State Representative Larry Hawes. I visited with Larry yesterday at his home. Some of you know he's suffering with cancer, going through chemotherapy for a brain tumor, and very, very serious situation. But he reminded me of our efforts here in the past, where he really promoted not only the summer youth employment program funded by the state, but programs at the Boys and Girls Clubs, that there was not duplication, that there was indeed plenty of work to go around. And we're just very proud to be part of his legacy. Our mission is to inspire and enable all young people to reach their full potential as productive, responsible, and caring citizens. Our national spokesperson, Denzel Washington, said, if it hadn't been for the club in his neighborhood, he never would have succeeded in life. He certainly wouldn't have discovered his great acting abilities. Clubs save lives. Your investment in this program is very, very important. The state of Minnesota is about 6.3% of our total funding stream. If you look at the second page of your packet with the pie chart, you'll see where our dollars come from. But frankly, foundation dollars, corporate dollars are being cut back in this economy at a time when we need them most. We ask you, please, not to cut back the funding. In the grand scheme of state funding, it's a small amount, but it does great good in our communities throughout Minnesota. And as a former Stearns County Commissioner, I've finished my 22nd year on the county board this year, and I served as chair of the Joint Powers Board at our Workforce Center. We do partner with the Workforce Center, we, the Boys and Girls Club. We also provide free memberships to the clubs for military children of military families. We provide free memberships for Big Brothers, Big Sisters, the littles in those programs. We reach out, we share our facilities and our programs with the community. We actually served 44,000 meals last year just in the St. Cloud area clubs alone. Basic needs, helping all kids succeed. We think you should hear from those children next. And so it's my pleasure to introduce two young people who are here today. Antonio Jenkins, who is a 14-year club member from the Southside Village Club in Minneapolis. And also we have our State Youth of the Year from 2010, Michelle Hobbs, who's from the Lincoln Park Club in Duluth, Minnesota. And we want them to just tell you how important this program has been to them.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name before you testify, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Antonio Jenkins, and I am 19 years old. I lived in Minnesota my whole life, and I've been a member of the Boys and Girls Club for about 14 years, and since then it's been the best decision of my life. I haven't had the easiest childhood and upbringing, but the one constant and most positive influence in my life has been the Boys and Girls Club programs, the staff. I credit them and forever indebted to them for the young man I've become today. If not for the club, I don't think I would be here today. Through tough times, the club staff was always there to guide me, advise me, and keep me on the right track. As a result, I took part in a couple of workforce training programs offered at my local club, such as Smart Moves, Stay Smart, and Job Ready. Programs like these are huge for the teens. Around my neighborhood, teens are constantly getting recruited into gangs, getting involved in other things that just aren't positive. When things aren't going well, whether it's at home, school, or life in general, such extracurricular activities at the club help keep teens on the right path, as they did for me. Through the above-mentioned programs, I put together a cover letter and a resume, learned essential interviewing strategies, and gained confidence talking to future employers. As a result, I was offered a job at my local Target. I remember being thankful for the things I learned during the various employments program, as I was able to put them into practice during the process of getting my new job. I also remember being very nervous before my interview, but I kept thinking that things we had covered in the programs, and when it came to the interview, I was feeling confident. You know, I have since left Target and pursued a career in what I feel is more of my passion, and that's working with young people. I feel obligated to give back in a way I saw others give to young people like me. I also, to this day, value the training I received and continue to receive. The workforce training programs taught me how to think, act, and carry myself as a professional. I still have a lot to learn, but I feel prepared walking into a professional setting because I have the right basic tools. Before the workforce training programs, I used to have the wrong approach to the job. I have since learned the basics of being a good worker, a good role model, and a professional. I have learned that although working for the Boys and Girls Club can be a fun job, but I also have a responsibility to the young people, staff, and myself to put the job first. For example, if during an intense and fun basketball game and a youth gets hurt, I will put the game on, have to put the game on pause and use this as a teachable moment to instruct the youth on the right way to do things. I have also learned more about the line between being a member and being a staff. Until not too long ago, I was a longtime member and did not have these responsibilities I have now. It was hard. It was a hard adjustment to make, and I continue to get better at making it with the help and guidance provided to me by the older and more experienced staff, as well as my previous workforce training. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of this committee, for taking the time to listen. I now yield my time to the chair.
Thank you. Some things he can teach us, doesn't he? Would you give your name for the record?
Good afternoon. My name is Michelle Hobbs. I'm the 2010 Boys and Girls Club State Youth of the Year from the Boys and Girls Club of the Northland in Duluth, Minnesota. I'm currently a freshman at the University of Minnesota, majoring in elementary education and minoring in Spanish. I first became involved with the Boys and Girls Club at the age of 7, and it was one of the best decisions I ever made. I'd like to talk about how important the workforce development programs have been for me. When I was in 6th grade, I became a member of the Smart Girls program at my Boys and Girls Club. This gave me the chance to meet with my peers each week in a safe, non-judgmental environment. We were able to talk freely about school, friends, family, peer pressure, and any other issue facing our lives. This program really helped me break out of my shell and become the friendly, intelligent woman I am today. In Smart Girls, I learned that I should be proud of who I am and that I don't need to change myself to fit in. I took this knowledge with me to high school, and I still use it today. I'm confident that I would not be attending such a great university without the help of another workforce program, Goals for Growth. This program was great for me because it allowed me to spend time with staff who truly care about me and want me to reach my goals. Each week, I was able to sit down with a staff member and talk about school, and they were always there to help me with my homework. When it came time to complete college applications and scholarship interviews, the club staff were there for me. They were willing to proofread my essays, and they even conducted practice interviews with me. Goals for Growth helped me get accepted into all 3 of the schools I applied for, and each time I received a college acceptance letter, the club staff were the first to hear about it. I'm proud to say that I'm the first person in my family to attend college, and I know this would not have been possible without the Boys and Girls Club. Some other very important workforce development programs for me are Career Launch and Job Ready. These programs helped me explore different career options, and it was through these programs that I became fully confident that I wanted to follow a career path in elementary education. Job Ready taught me the skills I needed to be successful in job applications and interviews and writing resumes. I started my first job as a locker room attendant at the Boys and Girls Club in Duluth when I was in 9th grade. This would not have been possible without the help of Job Ready. When I was in 11th grade, I got promoted to a youth development staff position, and I held that job until I moved here for college. Job Ready taught me the importance of professional job skills, such as being on time and how to communicate with an employer. My job at the Boys and Girls Club has really prepared me for jobs in other areas. At the club, I learned how to manage the relationships with coworkers and authority figures, how to be a productive, proactive employee, and how to ask for help when I needed it. I've learned the importance of punctuality and teamwork. Overall, my job at the club has molded me into someone who will be successful in any job I choose to pursue.
The skills I have acquired through workforce development programs are still with me today. This week, I had an interview to be on the student programming board at my school. I use my communication and interview skills that I've learned through the club, and I'm confident with my performance in this interview. I look forward to showcasing the skills I've learned at the club and all my future goals. Workforce development programs are an essential part of the mission of the Boys and Girls Club. They help young people reach their full potential as productive, caring, responsible citizens. These programs are necessary for teens because many of us come from families who may not have the time to help them learn the skills they need to be successful in work and school. Without these programs, many young people wouldn't know how to conduct themselves in an interview or even how to start the job search process. The workforce development programs give us the resources, support, and guidance we so desperately need to be intelligent, productive members of our society. The personal growth I've experienced from my time at the club has set me up for success in the workforce. I've become a motivated, knowledgeable woman with a very strong work ethic. Without these programs, I would not be on the path to a bright future. I am not only speaking for myself when I say I would not be where I am today without the workforce development programs, and I thank you for investing in our futures.
Representative Leidinger's got a question.
Yes, sir. I've got such a curiosity about something here. First of all, I love listening to the both of you. I think it's great seeing the youth sound so competent. Well, I was in recruiting for 2 years, U.S. Navy recruiting. My question to the both of you is, do you ever get exposure to the U.S. military, and you've ever had a thought of joining? Just curiosity.
You want an answer?
Mr. Chair, Representative?
Mm-hmm.
No.
No? Haven't been exposed to it? Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, I haven't personally been involved, but I know the Boys and Girls Clubs have strong, I don't know if it's a partnership, but I know they offer support to military families, and I think it's somewhere the kids who are from military families get support for their club fees, and we've talked about it at my Boys and Girls Club. It's just along with the jobs, you know, they say that's an option for you. Mm-hmm. So I haven't really been interested in it, but I know that it's available to the club members.
Okay. Thank you.
And now I would like to introduce Sharon Tutland, the board president of the Minnesota Alliance of Boys and Girls Clubs from Rochester, Minnesota.
Welcome to our committee.
Never a good idea to follow kids, right? Good afternoon, Chairman Gunther and committee members. My name is Sharon Tutland. I'm from Rochester, Minnesota, and I am the current volunteer president of the Minnesota Alliance of Boys and Girls Clubs. As you know, the Boys and Girls Club has a long history of serving low-income and vulnerable youth, and we also have a great reputation for doing that in a results-oriented and data-driven way. As Mark told you, the state of Minnesota provides about a little over 6% of our annual income, and for most of our clubs that provide workforce programs, your money is the major source of our workforce programs producing youth like you just heard from. In fact, these are two of thousands of stories like those that I wish that we could bring before you, because it just is so heart-rending. The results have been remarkable. I have two things I want you to know. Number one, right now, demand for Boys and Girls Club services is way up. I think it's because, you know, the economic downturn, we've got employment strains and fractured families, and they need a place, a safe place, constructive place for their kids to go. The other thing is, when you look at our current membership, our teen membership is up. In fact, I think we probably have an all-time high right now of about 43% of our total membership being teens. So you can see that continued funding of our programs is crucial to those folks who need us the most. Let me tell you a little bit about why I got involved. Like many of you, I am a business owner. And when I looked at their mission to ensure and enable that all youth could be productive, responsible, caring citizens, you know, I was hooked, especially that word productive. My husband and I owned a business, Schmidt Printing. It's one of the largest manufacturing businesses in Southeast Minnesota. And while we owned it, the employee base went from 11 employees to 400. We had a huge challenge as that happened, though, because we found an ever-decreasing quality in our labor pool. And we were appalled at the level of job applicants that we were getting. Schmidt Printing is a high-tech business, but the majority of jobs actually don't require more than a sixth grade level. And so we were using a high school diploma as sort of our benchmark for any employee. Well, we soon found out that a high school diploma did not guarantee a sixth grade level of reading or math or computer skills. And we actually started to give our own sixth grade competency test to make sure we had people who could work in back in the press and you know, let alone front office jobs. I think the sad thing is that this situation is not improving. And I am sorry to say that Minnesota has one of the highest percentages of youth in the achievement gap of any state in the nation. I've heard first, I've heard fourth, I've heard different, you know, pro rata. But the majority of the kids in the achievement gap are low income and they're minority. They're the very youth that are targeted by Boys and Girls Clubs. My business colleagues are concerned. We ask that the legislature come to the grips with the fact that not only is the labor pool shrinking, but those young people entering the workforce do not have the skills of the people, the baby boomers that are retiring. And without an educated workforce, how can our businesses function? How can they compete? Schools, they say, okay, this is a school problem, right? But schools really cannot handle and address this situation by themselves. They need the assistance of organizations like the Boys and Girls Club, who make sure that the kids don't fall. We know these kids. We make sure they don't fall through the cracks and land on those welfare rolls. If you support our Boys and Girls Club programs, you will actually be saving money. You'll be spending less for remedial education, health services, social services, law enforcement, juvenile justice programs, welfare programs. So investment in the Boys and Girls Club is a very wise investment. So how can we offer these great programs at such a low cost? I think it's because we're really great at leveraging our dollars. I cannot say enough about the support of the Boys and Girls Club of America. They give us unbelievable resources like free curriculums that have been tried and tested, organizational management tools that would rival any organization in the country, ongoing quality training for both our staff and our board members, the latest evidence-based research, evaluation tools, fundraising. I mean, they are amazing. Our staff at around the state for Boys and Girls Club consists of 500 part-time and full-time staff. So the second way we leverage is we have volunteers to supplement our staff. We have 2,200 volunteers working with 500 staff members. Third are our partners who provide us so much free expertise that we would not be able to pay for this expertise. We wouldn't have this professional expertise if we didn't have partners. We work with school districts and colleges and trade schools, student loan programs, health facilities, dental facilities, Head Start, county social services, law enforcement, juvenile justice system, arts organizations, youth organizations, tribal governments, and probably the one that we're most proud of right now, we have a recent new partnership with the State Chamber of Commerce. And what we're doing with them is we are working to give our kids hands-on, you know, in the business, on-the-job experience with career mentoring and job training. And our businesses have been wonderful, joining our boards, helping in our fundraising efforts, coming in and teaching financial management programs and so on. So anyway, we are very proud of that aspect. And I think we have to hurry and wrap up here. So I'm just going to say, I'll skip a few of the things. But as you can see, I'm just an absolute passionate supporter of the Boys and Girls Club. And I have to tell you, I've looked around because, you know, my time is valuable and I want to give it where I'm going to get the most bang for the buck. And I have not found another not-for-profit that is doing for society, socioeconomic status of our society, what the Boys and Girls Club is. And I have dedicated the rest of my adult non-working life to this effort. And taxpayers love us. They love us because we have a long-term benefits. You know, we train a child. That child doesn't just benefit for a year. We have 40 years of work experience. And I could go on, and I can't because we don't have time. But stable funding was really important. We've got success going. It's working. To interrupt our funding right now would be a real hardship. And I just ask that you consider continuing funding for Boys and Girls Clubs this year. and we'll entertain questions if you have them. I've got colleagues here from throughout the state. Are there any questions?
Any questions from the membership?
Mr. Chair, you talked a lot about, this is probably going to go back a little bit, when you're finding applicants that, you know, are kind of finding below. What was your, you know, obviously you got involved with Boys and Girls Club to kind of help kind of grow knowledge base so that they could reach some of your requirements. What do you think, you know, was your, if you could put a cost on that, to get people where they needed to be so that they could kind of get your basic needs as an employer, so that you could grow your own workforce after high school, those folks. What was your, if you could put a cost on it?
Question. I probably would need some help with that answer, but it's got to be a partnership. You know, what the Boys and Girls Club does, of course, is get kids ready for that first job on their resume. You know, we prepare them so that they are successful at the first job. And we have time because we start with the formative years, but you'd have to partner with all sorts of other organizations as well. Anybody back there want to give a cost?
Is he asking about what you have to pay as an employer?
Yeah. As you as an employer, so, you know, obviously Boys and Girls Club can assist with those things, but, mm-hmm. you know, what were the costs?
The training.
What would you do or right. whatever to mm-hmm. to right. be able to mm-hmm. fill jobs that you need
yeah,
to
Yeah, well, build. We did have to have some costs. We had to, you know, the cost of administering the test. We actually had some limited English speaking classes. Because we had a lot of refugees in Rochester at the time, and actually hired some great ones that are still with us. I don't have a dollar figure. If you would really like to know, I
could just kind of a
I'll ask my husband. I bet he could tell you.
Sure.
Any other questions of the children or, I'm sorry, young people?
Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony,
thank you so
and I appreciate your commitment. And with that, are there any other comments? Seeing none, we are adjourned.